The author of Bright Lights, Big City is not Bret Easton Ellis, of course. Jay McInerney wrote the book. It's a story about an aspiring writer who gets caught up in parties and drugs in 1980s New York. A collection of McInerney's short stories is now in paperback. It's called How It Ended. McInerney exploded onto the literary scene in the mid-1980s, just before Bret Easton Ellis made it big with Less Than Zero. And McInerney says it's what created a bond between them.
In many ways, we have a common enterprise in that we're both, in some sense, I guess, iconoclastic novelists. We also, you know, we went through kind of a maelstrom together that gives us a common bond. I mean, there aren't many writers who were thrown into the spotlight the way that we were, that were sort of processed so vigorously by the great American dream machine. And, you know, that gives us a kind of common bond of experience. Mm. But it didn't occur to me that we would be so closely identified and so closely yoked together. If I have to be part of a tag team, I'd just as soon have Bret on the other side.
So there's this 1985 buzz in the air. I mean, first, obviously, with Bret Easton Ellis' new book, and now with news that Bright Lights, Big City is being remade by Josh Schwartz, who is a co-creator of the TV show Gossip Girl. Do you think it sort of fits in today's world?
Well, at first, my feeling was that it was a book marked by the time, by the 80s, and that it was silly to try to update it. And then my second thought was that young people still come to New York to make their fortunes. People are still going out till all hours to nightclubs. Dare I say, there's a substance called cocaine, which is still widely used by people who go out to nightclubs and stay out all night. People still have their hearts broken, and they still lose their mothers. And ultimately, I think Bright Lights, Big City is a book that has some pretty universal concerns at its core. And in fact, I think the new version makes a lot of sense. We already did the 80s version, you know?
Mm. I remember how weird it was because it came out at the same time as The Secret of My Success, around the same time. And Michael J. Fox was in both of those movies, and it was very weird.
Well, yeah, it was actually a little bit of a mismatch, although I think he's a very fine actor. You know, he was so famous as a guy named Alex Keaton,
right?
From the television show
from Family Ties,
and he was a clean-cut, briefcase-toting Reagan Republican in that show, and it was very hard for people to see him in the role of a sort of jaded, coke-snorting downtown would-be literateur. The fact that he did a very good job didn't necessarily negate that.
In this collection of short stories that's now out in paperback, it starts with your first published story. It's called At 6 a.m., Do You Know Where You Are? Tell us how that story became your first published story.
I was at Syracuse University at graduate school, studying writing, creative writing, with Raymond Carver and Tobias Wolff. And I had sent a short story to George Plimpton at the Paris Review. And I got a call one day from George Plimpton, that amazing fluty voice, and telling me that he had read this story and kind of liked it, but he wondered if, before he made up his mind whether or not to publish it, whether I had anything else in the drawer. And so I stayed up all night rereading everything that I had ever written, and I realized it was all derivative crap, basically, and except for one paragraph that I unearthed that I'd written several months before, after spending the night out at a nightclub. And the first line of the paragraph was, "You're not the kind of guy who would be at a place like this at this time of the morning, but here you are." I found this voice strangely compelling. I thought, you know, this is the only thing I've ever written that sounds sort of authentic, that sounds different, that sounds like it might be something like my own voice. And so I sat up all night and wrote this story about a guy at a nightclub who's banging around sort of lost and forlorn and heartbroken, and pretty much within 24 hours, I sent it to the Paris Review, and that they accepted it shortly thereafter, and that became my first published story. But after a few months, I realized I wasn't quite done with the voice, and that the story really hadn't ended. I had just paused, and at that point, I sat down and, in very short order, wrote what became Bright Lights, Big City.
Now, I know there's been a lot of attention focused on a character in one of your previous novels named Alison Poole. She was apparently based on a friend of yours, the now infamous Riel Hunter, who, of course, had an affair with John Edwards. One of the short stories in this book is about Alison Poole. it reads almost like a diary of Riel Hunter's affair with John Edwards. I mean, obviously, it's a fictionalized account. What were you hoping to say about that episode that wasn't already said?
Well, nothing had been said about, or very little had been said about the episode when I wrote this story. Riel had just basically gone underground. So I wrote this story as a way of trying to imagine where my friend Riel had gone and what she was doing. And when I wrote this story, nobody knew where she had gone or what she was doing, except for Riel herself and presumably John Edwards. So it was a speculative exercise.
What did she think of the story?
She didn't seem to hold it against me. she liked the novel, which she and her circle of friends had inspired in many ways. And I just felt like I wasn't quite done with this character. And when she disappeared, I had limited information. And I decided to fill it in with my imagination.
Alison Poole was used by your colleague and friend, Brady Stenellis, in one of his novels. He actually...
Two of them,
right. He actually used...
Alison initially appears in American Psycho, and I was slightly horrified to be turning the pages as she has a date with Patrick Bateman. I was grateful, at least, that he didn't kill her. But it was touch and go there for a while.
As we heard earlier, Bret Easton Ellis has revisited Lesson Zero. The character is now decades on. Any chance that you would ever do that with Bright Lights?
I don't think that I will do a sequel to Bright Lights. I like the open-endedness of it, and I sort of like to think that all of my work is a sequel to Bright Lights, Big City. You know, each successive novel is a sort of possible sequel in a way. You know, each of my protagonists could be that guy, that aspiring novelist, that, you know, lost boy in the big city. I just don't know if 30 years later people want to hear me put on the second person again and revisit the old haunts. But that's not to say that I don't think it was a good idea for Brett to do so. Actually, I'm glad he did. But I don't think I'm going to, no.
That's Jay McInerney. His collection of short stories is called How It Ended. It's now out in paperback. He joined us from WLIU in Southampton, New York. Jay McInerney, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow on All Things Considered... That is the sound of an electric car, a very, very fast electric car. And while the big boys in Detroit and Yokohama are busy building their own versions, it's in the Silicon Valley, home of the iPod and microchip, where the real innovators are working on the future of driving.
It's the first time that we can compete, the collective society, with a destructive force, which is a gasoline car. Our mission is to end addiction to oil.
Tomorrow on the program, the story of an electric car company that wants Americans to think about something novel, sharing. And for Saturday, that's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Guy Raz. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon. Here's a joke you might recall from 1994.
Three tomatoes are walking down the street. Papa Tomato, Mama Tomato, and Baby Tomato. Baby Tomato starts lagging behind, and Papa Tomato gets really angry. Goes back and squishes him. Says, ketchup. Ketchup.
That was Uma Thurman, of course, in Pulp Fiction. Now, here's the thing. Centuries earlier, Uma couldn't have made that bad joke, not because it wasn't funny or because ketchup hadn't been invented yet, but because the tomato was viewed as poisonous, dangerous. Chefs shunned it. But gradually, it made its way into our diets, our homes, our tasteless jokes. Journalist Arthur Allen tells the story of the tomato's redemption, popularization, and eventual modification in his new book, Ripe: The Search for the Perfect Tomato. And he joins us now from the studios of member station WSUI in Iowa City, Iowa. Arthur Allam, welcome to Weekend Edition.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, I mentioned that in this book, you say that the tomato had really quite a hurdle in being introduced to Europe and North America because it was viewed as a poison. How did it win over its detractors?
I think it was just, you know, the tomato has a way of sort of wearing you down because it's unavoidable. There's so many different ways that you can eat it. And I think it caught on with the peasantry first in the south, in the Mediterranean, where it grows so well. And, you know, doctors all thought that tomatoes were poisonous, and that finally gave way to good sense and taste.
Mm-hmm. Another surprising chapter in tomato history is a court actually ruled about whether it was a vegetable or a fruit. Could you tell us about that?
Yes. None other than our own Supreme Court was called in to answer this question when vegetable and fruit importers were trying to get the New York Customs Office to allow them to import tomatoes without a duty. And at the time, you could import fruit without a duty, but vegetables had a surcharge. And they argued that tomatoes were not a vegetable. They were a fruit. And the court found that, yes, botanically, tomatoes are a fruit, but they're legally a vegetable.
There's that wonderful notion of throwing a rotten tomato at a politician or an actor. Apart from the legal niceties, why don't we do that any longer?
Well, I think it's because tomatoes are too hard now. And so it stops becoming a kind of gentle act of defiance that only leads to a dry cleaning bill, to something that, you know, could get you serious time in prison. I mean, you know, and you want those soft, goopy tomatoes if you're going to really get a politician or a bad musician. So I think we could still use our backyard tomatoes for throwing at politicians, but not commercial tomatoes.
Now, why this particular produce? I know that writers have been looking at salt or fish or certainly lots and lots of books on bread. You chose the tomato. Why?
Started out actually looking at strawberries, but I just found tomatoes are a much richer subject. I mean, there's just so many stories and lore, and they mean so much to many of us. I mean, anyone who cares about food usually has strong feelings about tomatoes. And part of the reason is just because, in a sense, the tomato is the original back garden summer edible that you remember from your grandmother's garden or your own garden. And then just the changes in the tomato and the way that people are often dissatisfied with, you know, the Safeway tomato or the supermarket tomato. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to find out, you know, how the supermarket tomato got to be the way it is.
Has the advent of the small farmer growing heirloom varieties and the farmers markets that we see had any impact on this massive global tomato enterprise? Does our desire for something really tasty right now make a difference?
I think it has. I mean, I think for one thing, you're seeing a lot more interest in the larger commercial tomato growers to introduce varieties that have flavor. I mean, flavor for decades was really an afterthought. Nowadays, if you want to compete, you can sell tomatoes at a higher price if you have more flavor.
Well, what is your favorite kind to grow?
I like the early girls because the sort of local season in Washington just started in the last few weeks. When I was in California, I had some that I really loved called the speckled peach. And so I brought the seeds back and I tried to grow them and they came out completely nothing burger tomatoes. And we just realize it's something about California, you know, the sun, the soil, whatever it is. And that's very characteristic of tomatoes, that certain types go in certain areas. But just the sheer diversity in the color and shape and so on is just very appealing. Because part of gardening is just the fun of it and the aesthetics of it. And then we fool ourselves into thinking that, you know, these are wonderful tomatoes when really they're just average.
Thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your tomato quest with us. Arthur Allam is the author of Ripe, The Search for the Perfect Tomato. Thanks for being with us.
It's been my pleasure. Have a nice tomato-y summer.
Read about one grower's golden honey bunch tomatoes, which Allam describes as so extravagantly flavored they're nearly tropical, in an excerpt from Ripe at our website, npr.org. The shadowy website WikiLeaks posted tens of thousands of classified documents about the war in Afghanistan earlier this week, prompting a criminal investigation and calls from some congressional Democrats to rethink American involvement there. As NPR's David Folkenflik reports, the episode has sparked an intense debate on the nature of WikiLeaks and the way the news came out.
What exactly is WikiLeaks? New York Times executive editor Bill Keller seeks precision in his answer.
I've shied away from the term whistleblower because that has a kind of, you know, halo around the term. But they're an advocacy organization. They have a point of view and an ideology, and they have a modus operandi, which consists of getting information wherever they can and making it public.
To do that, WikiLeaks used servers in countries across the globe to evade detection and software to cloak leakers in anonymity. Its Australian leader, Julian Assange, lives a nomadic life, saying he has to avoid angered governments. He says soldiers have probably committed war crimes in Afghanistan and Iraq and opposes the U.S. presence there. But Assange also calls himself editor-in-chief, a news executive's title, and just listen to how he answered this question from NPR's Robert Siegel.
The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mullen, said that these leaks could put American lives at risk. If that were true, would it bother you? Would it deter you at all from the leak?
In journalism, we should actually ignore people that say something might happen or could happen. We should look to people saying something that something probably would happen.
We journalists, he says. WikiLeaks posts all kinds of secrets, including the rituals of sororities and Masons and Mormons. Stephen Aftergood is director of the Government Transparency Project for the Federation of American Scientists. He says WikiLeaks often fails to ask fundamental journalistic questions. Does the material it posts involve public policy or accountability? Does it injure anyone?
It seems that they have adopted a stance that secrecy is always wrong, and disclosure, even if it's compulsory, unwilling disclosure of private individuals' records, is always justified. And to my mind, that's not just wrong, it's idiotic and dangerous.
Yet Aftergood praises the decision here to involve experienced journalists. Assange gave the New York Times, The Guardian in the UK, and Der Spiegel in Germany an advanced look so they could authenticate documents and develop detailed pieces. Keller said the Times presented findings to Pentagon officials, relaying concerns back to WikiLeaks. Times editors withheld materials they felt might endanger Americans, Afghan civilians, or the war effort. And Assange himself held back 15,000 documents, at least for now. The author and journalist Shane Harris covers intelligence issues for Washingtonian magazine. In this case, Harris says, Assange played a journalistic, or at least a journalistic-ish, role.
There's obviously no accreditation process for something like this, but in this case, yeah, I think he is actually acting like an editor. I mean, to me, I almost look at him in this particular instance as someone who got a hold of information from a source, decided that he wanted to bring in some other journalists to partner with him in the publication of that information. They sort of did a joint partnership. It's like, you know, New York Times pairing with Frontline or something, I guess.
Not so, says Times editor Bill Keller.
Well, first of all, I don't call it a collaboration or an alliance because that suggests some shared purpose and it suggests that they had some involvement in what we did with the material, which they did not. They were a source.
He says the documents provide texture and heft to earlier reporting about Afghan civilian deaths and to ties between Pakistani intelligence and the Taliban. And Keller says WikiLeaks would have posted the documents no matter what his newspaper did.
WikiLeaks doesn't need the New York Times or the Guardian. It has the ability to publish and circulate its stuff around the world instantaneously.
Julian Assange says he did not simply bypass the established media this time because he's been frustrated with the lack of coverage for earlier disclosures. He says the exclusive arrangements with the three publications gave their reporters time to write about the documents and incentive to do so.
Well, that is a journalist's job, of course, is to take the material and turn it into some story and put their reputation behind it.
The game changer is the speed and the anonymity afforded by WikiLeaks. The surprise is that the Spectral new publisher showed it too can find a new way to play by the rules when it wants to. David Folkenflik, NPR News.
is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. The BP oil spill is on its way to becoming what some say will be the most massive tort litigation ever. And as both sides lawyer up, as they say, they're also trying to hire the best and brightest scientists to help make their case. But as NPR's Tovia Smith reports, that's raising concerns.
As soon as the magnitude of the Gulf oil spill became clear, it was all hands on deck.
That's the Black Mangrove. Their distribution and range has expanded over the past 20 years in coastal Louisiana. You wouldn't have seen this 20 years ago.
For months now, local scientists like LSU wetlands expert Andy Nyman have been out on Gulf waters advising the cleanup and measuring the damage.
Some of the carbon being photosynthesized by these marsh grasses today will be part of a menhaden that will end up in a piece of chicken that then you cook on your stove.
But there is growing concern that some of the best minds are being sidelined since they've signed on as paid consultants to BP.
Everybody's arming up for the big day in court.
Richard Shaw, director of Louisiana State University's Coastal Fisheries Institute, is one of many concerned that BP is buying up too much of the region's brain power.
You would think you would want to bring all the intellectual resources to bear. It's pretty frustrating.
Shaw says he has not been approached by BP, but many colleagues have.
I got a phone call from some lawyers representing BP.
University of South Alabama's Bob Shipp says BP's lawyers tried to hire his whole Department of Marine Sciences to do research for them. Under the deal, the scientists could only disclose their results if BP said so. Otherwise, they'd have to keep it secret for 3 years.
They wanted the oversight authority to keep us from publishing things if for whatever reason, they didn't want them to be published. People were muzzled as part of the contract. They were muzzled, and certainly it's not something that we could live with.
But other professors did accept BP offers at LSU, Texas A&M, and the University of Southern Mississippi. After a blast of public criticism, however, the Mississippi professors had a change of heart and backed out. They declined to comment. It's touchy, not just because of the academic integrity issue, but also public opinion.
I am a little concerned about everyone hating me if I was working for BP, so.
LSU wetlands scholar Andy Nyman chose instead to work for a lawyer suing BP. His deal calls only for expert testimony, not research, and he's not subject to any hush clause. But Nyman says he can only surmise how many others are, either for BP or the government agencies who will oppose them in court.
I'm guessing from the volume of people who are wetland experts that you do not hear from in the press right now that everyone but me is locked in.
BP declined to be interviewed for this report, but in a statement, BP says its deals vary from large, no-strings-attached grants to universities to, quote, scientific experts for the purpose of litigation that need to be confidential.
It's the way things work. I mean, this happens every day, and no one should be surprised.
Mark Davis heads Tulane Law School's Institute on Water Resources Law and Policy. In some ways, he says BP is doing what other oil, tobacco, and pharmaceutical companies have done in the past by hiring scientists to do research they want kept secret. But he says in a case like this, the public will pay a big price if BP can constrain the free flow of scientific data.
When the best fishery scientists actually may have evidence that would work against you, but they're not able to present it to the other side or to the public, well, then you've essentially bought some silence.
It's a cagey legal strategy, but I do think it's a problem from a public standpoint.
That's attorney Robert Weigel, who represents fishermen, businesses, and environmental groups who are suing BP. He says the public interest really depends on access to a relatively small pool of specialists.
When you talk about the red snapper fishery or black mangrove swamps, there may be half a dozen people who fully understand those resources, and there needs to be full exchange of data so that we can all understand what happened to these public resources.
To many in academia, an underlying problem is the lack of other options for research. Shaw says universities have all but cut back and federal grant money has all but dried up.
There's a bunch of frustration. I mean, believe me, everybody, all the scientists want to get out there and contribute, for crying out loud. I mean, it's in our backyard. And so we're sitting there chafing at the bit, trying to get into the mix.
It only makes a lucrative offer like those from BP, Shaw says, all the more enticing. Tovia Smith, NPR News, New Orleans.
Even WikiLeaks is unlikely to penetrate the secrecy surrounding DEFCON 18. That's not some Department of Homeland Security designation like Code Orange. It's the 18th annual convention of hackers going on this week in Las Vegas. Thousands of hackers, security specialists, and IT administrators are gathered for the concurrent DEFCON and Black Hat computer conferences. Declan McCullough is the chief political correspondent and a senior writer at CNET.com, and he's covering the conferences and joins us from Las Vegas. Welcome.
Hello. It's good to be here.
What are the differences between these two conferences, DEFCON and Black Hat?
Well, Black Hat is the one that you can tell your boss you're going to. It's held at the Caesars Palace Hotel, which has beautiful ballrooms. It's very above board. It's very buttoned down, and you have a lot of people wearing polo shirts. But DEFCON, which takes place at the end of the week, is something that you just may not want to broadcast to your going to if you're boss doesn't exactly like a bunch of hackers running around a hotel trying to figure out how to break into things.
Are there any leaks so far on what might be the big news coming out of this DEFCON conference?
There are a few surprise speakers, and so we're waiting to see who those are going to be. There is someone from WikiLeaks who is supposed to be on the program. We don't know whether he's going to show up or even set foot in the country because of the recent disclosure. But DEFCON has always been a place where you have people who are pushing the envelope of what is allowed by law, what's allowed even within the hacker culture. I mean, I was at DEFCON in 2001 when you had a Russian programmer, Dmitry Sklyarov, who showed up and gave a presentation about how to decrypt, how to bypass the copy protection on Adobe eBooks. And the FBI arrested him and on charges of violating U.S. copyright law.
Let me ask you about that. I mean, it does get tricky, and this has gotten some play. I mean, I understand that a security tester has already shown everyone how to hack into an ATM at the push of a button.
He gave a presentation at Black Hat. The summary is that he bought a few ATMs, either the standalone ones you might find in restaurants or convenience stores, kind of the smaller ones. And he bought them over the internet because you can buy everything over the internet, took them apart, and found ways to compromise the security of them. And in about 5 seconds, you can insert some code that tricks the computer into spitting out cash. There is a caveat. He was going to give the speech last year, and the ATM manufacturers applied some pressure. He didn't. But in the last year, they've fixed their systems. And so all the systems that have been upgraded since are secure. But, you know, there probably are quite a number that have not received the security updates in the last year, and those are still vulnerable. He's not releasing the software, though.
I see. All right. So, but he might be one of the people getting a tap on the shoulder before he leaves that conference.
Absolutely.
But on the other hand, I understand Michael Hayden, the former CIA director, attended Black Hat. What's he doing out there? This is also, of course, the former head of the National Security Agency, Michael Hayden.
There's always been this odd relationship between hackers and three-letter agencies inside the U.S. government. Early on, they showed up at DEFCON without announcing themselves, and there were prizes, T-shirts given at the end for spotting the Fed. And if you saw someone wearing shorts and a crew cut, and then there's probably a pretty good chance that person was a Fed. But since then, the CIA, the NSA, it's really especially the NSA, which does a lot of code making and code breaking, they've realized that this is a good place to recruit. Instead of breaking our systems from the outside, this is the sales pitch. You can come and work for the government, get a security clearance, and break them from the inside and be able to do some pretty interesting things you may not be able to outside.
Well, Declan McCullough, thank you very much.
Anytime.
Declan McCullough is the chief political correspondent and senior writer with CNET.com, and he joined us from the DEFCON conference in Las Vegas. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. A controversial Army Experience Center in a northeast Philadelphia shopping mall closed yesterday after a 2-year pilot program. As Windsor Johnston of member station WRTI reports, the Army declared its outreach efforts at the multi-million-dollar facility a mission accomplished.
Using screen names such as Warlord and Number One Shooter, teenage boys sit in a row of army green recliners facing flat screen monitors, challenging each other in video games of war.
See, he really, really gonna try to kill me too. I don't know where he is.
19-year-old Kevin Houston and 18-year-old Damian King square off in the popular Call of Duty game, Modern Warfare.
No, that was you I hit, that wasn't it?
Once visitors register and prove that they are 13 years or older, they're given free access to the facility's array of war-themed games. Army Experience Center spokesman Captain John Kirchkessner says the center has proven more effective than traditional recruiting methods.
By use of technology and by way of basically creating a relationship with the community is a much better way to share our Army story than to simply smile and dial and ask somebody if they've thought about joining lately.
The facility also houses three simulators, including an Apache and Black Hawk helicopter and an armored combat Humvee. 18-year-old John Galato and three of his 15-year-old friends sit atop the Army vehicle with a lifelike machine gun in hand. Galato says experience like this will help prepare him for the future.
I'm going to be killing people. So I'm actually joining the Marines, so I'll be doing this in real life one day soon.
When given the green light, the four teens begin maneuvering through virtual war zones, shooting at targets while dodging bullets themselves. But these simulated war experiences have been met with strong opposition. Combat veteran Staff Sergeant Jesse Hamilton says the Army has sanitized the horrors of combat.
People screaming, blood, flies, horrible smells, the list goes on and on. And they've taken all of that out, and what they've effectively left is the portion which they consider to be the fun part.
Captain Kirchkessner says recruits are well aware of the dangers of combat.
If you were to ask any one of them, do you feel as though the Army is going to be like playing with a controller or a game? They're going to say absolutely not. You know, that's crazy to even think that.
Five nearby recruiting offices were closed when the Philadelphia Center opened in 2008. Since then, an estimated 240 recruits have enlisted at the Army Experience Center. While overall recruitment rates in the area have stayed the same, Kirchkessner says the facility reached that number with half the staff. This fall, two new Army Opportunity Centers will open in the Philadelphia region, downscaled versions of the Experience Center. For NPR News, I'm Windsor Johnston in Philadelphia.
This is NPR News.